million.
We're going to go ahead and get started. We're a little bit behind schedule, and I want to try to get us back on track. My name is Jean Atkinson. I'm the executive director at CLINIC, Catholic Legal Immigration Network. Welcome. I'm delighted to have you all here, and I'm delighted to follow Director Rodriguez because he really set up this panel that I'll be moderating this morning. He spoke of a broad spectrum of organizations that play a role in this issue and how immigrants energize our economy. He also mentioned how the federal government, how the administration is looking at stepping into the void created by the lack of congressional action. And that is essentially what we're going to be speaking about this morning. Since 2007, state legislatures have introduced approximately 1,300 laws and resolutions related to immigration each year. Last year, lawmakers in 45 states and the District of Columbia enacted 437 laws and regulations covering a wide range of issues, including higher education, enforcement, and migrant and refugee programs. At the same time, civic organizations are focusing attention on integration, on the economic, social, and cultural value that immigrants bring to their communities. It is my privilege to introduce three distinguished panelists who will speak about how state, cities, and local entities have filled the void of congressional action. They represent three different sectors engaging in immigration issues outside the purview of the federal government. In the interest of time, I'm not going to read their bios. You have them in your programs, and I encourage you to look at them because they have varied and extensive experience that I would love you to read about. But I would like to introduce Nisha Agarwal. To my immediate right, she's the commissioner of the New York City Mayor's Office of Immigrant Affairs. Then Senator Ricardo Lara represents the 33rd District in the California State Senate. And Steve Tobachman is the director of Global Detroit, leading the city's economic revitalization. I'm going to stand because we're going to do this in kind of a question and answer format so that we can look at some issues from these different sectors. And then I will save time at the end for you all to have questions. So, Nisha, I'd love to start with you. Can you talk about the role that the mayor's office plays and your commission plays in helping to fill the gap in benefits and gaps in New York City?
Sure. So first of all, thank you so much for having me and for the conference organizers, for having New York City represented here today on this panel. I guess one thing I'll say to start is some context, which is that in New York City, one out of three individuals is foreign-born or an immigrant. That's more people than the city of Chicago. When you add their kids, it's 60% of New York City. So there's not an aspect of life in the city that isn't impacting immigrant families and vice versa. So it's really something that's been front and center for city government for a long time. My office is essentially the bridge between City Hall and New York City's many immigrant communities, and we have a very simple mission, which is to promote programs and policies that improve the well-being of immigrant communities. And in Mayor de Blasio's administration, we have three broad goals by which we sort of fulfill that mission. And the first is really to think about how to embed immigrant inclusion throughout the city's DNA in a way. So it's not just the Mayor's Office of Immigrant Affairs that's thinking about immigrant well-being, but it's really a part of the code of the city overall. And I think one good example of this that the Mayor announced in January when he first took office is the city's municipal ID card program. So this is creating a government-issued local identification that's available to all, regardless of immigration status, and is really meant to function as a key to the city to open doors that were closed before to people who didn't have ID, but also really to kind of equalize access to many of the services and amenities in New York. And I'm happy to talk more about that later. Another broad goal of ours is access to justice, and whether it's sort of on one end of the spectrum of individuals facing deportation and needing adequate representation to defend themselves in those cases, all the way to naturalization and citizenship, the city has invested a lot of resources, has a number of different programs available to help people sort of move down that continuum, and we're currently thinking about executive action and how we'll prepare for that at the local level as well, so it's a major goal. And then the third is really where my background comes in, which is advocacy, and how does the city, as New York, serve as an advocate at the state level, right? New York has somewhat shamefully failed to pass the DREAM Act still. And how do we function as an advocate at the federal level for eventual immigration reform and certainly to support the president when he announces executive action? So that's really how we think about our role, and I'm happy to talk about any of those initiatives in more detail.
Senator, can you tell me what the California legislature has been working on regarding immigration? And also, how do you look at what's happening in cities such as LA and San Francisco?
Great, thank you. It's great to be here. Buenos dias. You know, as we in California continue to address the fact that, you know, Congress's complete failure to enact any type of comprehensive immigration reform, California has to lead, given the fact that we are the most diverse, most populous state in the country. And our legislature feels compelled to continue to serve as that kind of role model in terms of how do we affect positive change and ensure that we incorporate all of our immigrant communities into our society. And so in California, we've continued to pass, you know, legislation after legislation with the hope that one day we get comprehensive immigration reform. But until then, there's families in Californians that continue to be torn apart. And we see it on a daily basis. When we go back to our districts, when you know, we're in our community, when we're in our churches, we see the struggle that people are going through right now with the fact that we can't come up with some sort of comprehensive immigration reform. And so the responsibility falls on the different states and in city governments and local organizations. And so what we've done in California has continued. You know, we like to say we continue to lead where Congress has continued to fail. And when it comes to the driver's license bill, we finally got that passed. But we got that passed with the safeguards to ensure that we protect the individual's identity and that we protect their human and civil rights to ensure that they're not victims of any discrimination. And with likewise, we've seen case after case, and I'm sure you guys are aware of how professional students that are now graduating and are DREAM Act students are graduating, finishing law school, finishing their professional studies, yet lack the opportunity to actually pursue their career. And so this year, instead of doing it by piecemeal like we were doing it in the legislature, we decided to just do a blanket bill that would cover all the different 40 professions that require a professional license and no longer just require a Social Security, but an ITIN number to be able to qualify for that. And then allow the students or the professional to pursue their career and act as an independent contractor or open their individual business. Again, understanding that the more folks have an opportunity to economic prosperity, the better our state is in. And California being a nation state and being the eighth largest economy in the world, continuing to promote that amongst all our residents remains a priority. We've just surpassed Russia and Italy's economy. We're on schedule to surpass France and the UK, putting us back as the sixth largest economy. So our legislature wholeheartedly believes that we need to ensure that everybody has that opportunity for that economic prosperity, and that includes our undocumented community.
Steve, I will mention that Steve was a former Michigan state legislator. So as we talk about the interaction in these, I think he brings a second layer to the conversation. Can you tell us a little bit about Global Detroit and what your role is in interacting with the city of Detroit as well as the state of Michigan?
Sure. So again, also I want to thank the sponsors for inviting us and having a voice from the Midwest, the heartland. We have a very different demographic makeup than either of our coasts and our where most immigrants enter, but I think a critical and important place where I think we're trailblazing new concepts and new ideas about immigration and what it means for our communities in the heartland. So Global Detroit is a regional economic development initiative. We are not an immigration per se initiative. We're certainly not an immigrant rights or an advocacy organization. And we came together in the height of Michigan and Detroit's Metro Detroit's economic crisis in 2009. And I could get into some really woeful statistics, but really no state has ever had a decade as bad relative to the other states in the country as what Michigan had in the 2000s. And so at the height of this economic depression in Michigan, the Detroit Regional Chamber of Commerce, foundations, and other community leaders began to ask a number of questions about what does the future look like. And one of those questions was, what role do immigrants play in the economy? And what are the opportunities and what are the challenges? And so out of that, we found a number of really powerful statistics that actually are shared all across kind of the Rust Belt and the industrial heartland of this country, where immigration is and immigrants really make jobs and really power the economy in, I would say, largely untold ways here in either national media or federal congressional debates. And so just briefly, you know, I'll just try to throw two of what is probably about 30-some factoids or statistics that we commonly use at Global Detroit. From 1995 through 2005, according to Vivek Wadhwa in research at Duke University and UC Berkeley, 32.8%, about a third, of Michigan's high-tech firms had an immigrant founder or co-founder. And this is a state where there's only 5 to 6% foreign-born, meaning you're about six times as likely in Michigan to start a high-tech firm than those born in the U.S. who live in our state. And it's, I could get into all kinds of statistics on, we happen to have an immigrant population that's more educated than our native-born population, and frankly, educated in the right fields. International students play a really powerful role in our universities and colleges. But it's not just high-tech immigrants, and it's not just the STEM and the H-1Bs and the things that you see the tech entrepreneurs trying to get. Frankly, we are the only state that lost population. And our city, the city of Detroit, you know, you read lots of headlines, but largest municipal bankruptcy in the history of America. You know, there are lots of reasons for that, and there's been a lot of, but one that I don't think gets published often enough, or very rarely, is that we are still the 18th largest city in the country with about 700,000 people in the 2010 census, but we actually have the 135th largest foreign-born population with only 35,000 immigrants in the city of Detroit. The region, Metro Detroit, has 400,000 immigrants and compares fairly well across the Midwest. But the city really struggles. In fact, there's no other of the top 25 largest cities in the country that fall outside the top 100, and only one other that even falls outside the top 50 in terms of the size of its foreign-born population. So in a state that is rapidly aging, like much of the Midwest, like Pennsylvania and Ohio, frankly, immigrants across the board, from working-class immigrants who work in our agriculture industry, which is our second largest industry in the state of Michigan after manufacturing, to powering our research universities and medical complexes and tech firms and automotive design, information technology, are really probably the most powerful economic development strategy we have going for us. And so I lead an initiative that seeks to capitalize on that, that has launched between 6 and 10, depending on how you want to count, independent initiatives like the country's first international student retention program. But, and I'll just conclude with this, as I mentioned, we are part of a growing movement in the Midwest that has come to this reality. So in just the last 4 years, a St. Louis Mosaic initiative similar to ours was launched. Welcome Dayton was launched in the city of Dayton. The Chicago Office of New Americans, Vibrant Pittsburgh, Global Cleveland, and similar initiatives are being formed in Cincinnati, Toledo, Buffalo, and all across the Midwest. And there are literally almost a dozen. We worked collectively as something called the Global Great Lakes Network, and it's exciting work, and it's important work, and it really is focused on kind of national and regional and local economic policy.
Great. I'm going to follow up with you again, Steve, for a minute. Director Rodriguez said that absent federal action, congressional action, we cannot do it all. So with employment-based visas, you can't create them, or other types of visas. What strategies do you use to overcome those types of challenges?
Sure. Well, make no mistake that the biggest economic boost would be a more sensical and higher-performing federal immigration policy that works for local economies, and maybe even is localized, because clearly the challenges that we face in Detroit are very different than in Long Beach or New York City, and our skill sets and needs are very different, and probably one-size-fit-all policy might not work as well. But absent that, we're trying to do everything we can to take advantage of the opportunities that we have, and frankly, a lot of that work would prepare us well if some kind of immigration reform policy was passed. So what do we do? One is, I mentioned international students, something called we launched the Michigan Global Talent Retention Initiative. I keep saying at conferences, I'm waiting for someone to contradict me, that we're the first and maybe only international student retention program in the country. We have 3 full-time staff. We have agreements with 31 colleges and universities in the state of Michigan that represent most if not all, of the 28,000 international students studying in our state, which is, by the way, an $800 million export product for our universities and local communities. And what we do is we inform the students of the opportunities under the law to use their curricular practical training or their optional practical training under their F visa to work both while they're in school and after graduation. And we highlight to employers the opportunities of using the optional practical training as a gateway to perhaps investing more in depth via an H-1B application or other means. And we can't answer long-term employment needs for this talent pool, but we can certainly create some gateways and opportunities. And we do a lot of education. We have 60 what we call GO or global opportunity employers who have agreed to look at international student talent. And when you consider the fact that between 40 and 50% of all the masters and PhDs in engineering, life sciences, computer sciences, physical sciences are given to international students, it is insane that we don't have more policies to connect this incredible talent pool. We have the world's most talented people coming to this country. In fact, I mentioned a statistic about 32.8% of our high-tech firms. Follow-up research suggests that the average high-tech entrepreneur, immigrant entrepreneur, starts their company 13 years after they come to the country, and the number one reason why they come to the country is to get an education. So we see our international student retention program as the pipeline to becoming the Silicon Valley of the Midwest. And we also look at how do we better connect skilled immigrants who are underemployed and unemployed, the so-called brain waste syndrome that a lot of national players, we happen to have the fourth office of Upwardly Global, a nonprofit that has offices in San Francisco, New York, and Chicago, and I think now they're opening one in Maryland, I believe. We're very happy to have their fourth office in the city of Detroit. To work with skilled immigrants and refugees. You know, when we were getting about 2,000 or 2,500 Middle Eastern refugees a year, and while they, from just anecdotal experience, I don't have the statistics, I think some of the first people that are able to get out of the conflicts of Syria, some of the issues in Iraq, frankly, are the most affluent and educated. And so they come to the Metro Detroit. Frankly, we have one of the highest Middle Eastern populations in raw number than anywhere in the country, in fact, more than New York, a little bit less than LA, but certainly the highest concentration of Middle Eastern Americans. And they're working restaurant jobs, they're working menial labor jobs, and these are engineers, these are accountants, these are people with IT backgrounds, and so what we're doing is recredentialing them, looking at our state laws and licensing guides and helping them. So those are just a couple of the ways that we're trying to connect talent under the existing broken immigration system.
Thank you. So Isha, can you tell us about New York's workforce initiative programs?
Sure. So right now, New York's workforce system is going through a big rethink, under the auspices of a new task force called Jobs for New Yorkers. And this comprises both sort of city leaders as well as advocates in the field and other stakeholders. And what's notable about it, one of the kind of facts that obviously jumped out at me in the first meeting of the task force was that one out of two of the unemployed or underemployed are foreign-born in New York City. And it's clear, and I hear this every time I'm meeting with groups, that our workforce system is really not working for immigrants. And so one of the things we've been doing with the Jobs for New Yorkers task force is really convening groups to understand how the workforce system can respond better to immigrant communities in particular. Some of it's low-hanging fruit, right? The fact that DACA recipients are now eligible for some of the Title I workforce services, which they weren't before, I don't think our workforce system has been trained on that, sort of making sure that people are connected to the services that they are entitled to now. But then also thinking about learning from places like Michigan and Detroit, thinking about how we can do better by our high-skilled workforce. How do we also look at the low-wage workforce and connect them to the economic system as a whole so that it's functioning better for them? You know, we had a convening that was co-sponsored by us, the Ford Foundation, Cerna Foundation, and I think the kind of big reality check for the workforce folks in the room was that there's a huge informal economy, right, where largely undocumented immigrants are working. If executive action happens and folks get work authorization, suddenly that invisible workforce, which is huge in New York City, is no longer so invisible, and is the workforce system prepared to be able to work with that population? And I think the answer is no, not yet. And so we're really trying to think about, at the system level, what we can do about that. And it's somewhat daunting, but I think we're or moving in that direction, and we'll learn from others who've done a really great job in this area.
Thank you. Senator, you've championed initiatives including California's driver's license bill, which passed, and a measure that would extend health care for all, which did not. What role do you think the state should play in connecting immigrants to social and other services?
I think it's the state's complete role to help its residents and all its residents. And so as we talk about, for example, the Health for All bill, which will be reintroduced next year, and I'm very confident we're going to get that signed, we looked at the fact that our own experiences with working with folks as we were signing people up to the ACA, we realized that a large group of folks will live in mixed households. So when people would come and try to sign up for the ACA, then they would realize that, wait, my spouse, my two children can't apply because they're undocumented. So none of the families would register because they didn't want to leave anybody out. And so we realized that we need to do something about that again. And either whether it's creating a state exchange very similar to what the ACA does, or expanding our Medi-Cal so that we can cover those folks that can't afford to pay, becomes a necessity for us. Because if a person is sick, or their child is sick, then they don't go to school, they don't go to work, and it impacts our economy directly. The other thing is California spends $1.7 billion annually on emergency room care. And this is where we know where our undocumented population is going. And that threatens everybody's health care, and especially in a life or death situation where our emergency rooms are completely booked for issues that can be treated by, just having a doctor and access to a doctor. And so we in the legislature feel that this is the next step in terms of immigrant rights, of human rights, and we're going to continue to work on this issue. We've put a task force together of folks. Now, the thing is, you guys have heard from our governor. He's like, how are we going to pay for this? And this is what we're working on right now, is how do we create a funding mechanism to help this critical population, which everybody is trying to work for. And so you're going to see some creative ways that might not, that some of our immigrant rights groups nationally might not agree with, but there are ideas that we're looking at on how we cover this population, because we know that if they have access to health care, again, it's about incorporate them into our society, ensuring that they have the wherewithal to some sort of upward mobility, and access to affordable health care is part of that.
You've also recently provided funding for representation for unaccompanied children.
Yes. Very proud of the fact that California is the only state that actually provided $3 million from our budget to help these children. We met with some of the biggest law firms in Southern California, with our attorney general, and we realized that the nonprofits, the legal aid folks that are working on these cases don't have the resources to be able to attend to all the caseloads that's coming up that are growing with these children. And understanding the fact that the United States is responsible for what's happening, has to take responsibility for what's happened in Central America over years. And so when we were debating what we were gonna do to help these refugee children, we decided that we needed to do, and understanding also that the cases, if a child is represented by an attorney, the chances of them actually gaining a stay is much greater than having, a 10-year-old or a 5-year-old go before a judge on their own. We've heard anecdotally that of some of the children that already have been returned, some of them have actually been murdered already. And so it just broke our heart. And it is just a drop in the bucket of what we could do for the kids in California. So we apportioned $3 million that are going to go to help these organizations to ensure that when they partner with the legal team, that the case is actually prepared for, so it doesn't take the attorney that much more longer to actually take the case before a judge. And again, instead of shunning these children, understanding that these are children that are in need. Nobody leaves or flees their country because they just want to on a whim. These are children that are in dire need. And if this was happening anywhere around the world, in Europe or anywhere else, we would do the same thing. And so we're very proud of the fact that we were able to do that. and we're going to monitor it and continue to see if we can give more money to this effort.
Nisha, I'm sure you're proud of what New York City is doing also for unaccompanied children.
Yeah, we, both the city council, the administration, and then private philanthropy really came together in New York to respond to the child migrant issue. The city administration, we formed an internal task force of mainly city agencies to figure out how we can best coordinate resources for the kids, specifically focused on things like educational and health resources. And so our city agencies are now actually located at the immigration court, which I think in New York we have really great immigration judges, and they were really excited to have us there, connecting the kids both to school enrollment as well as to Child Health Plus and other health benefits they may be eligible for. And we're running a series of community clinics connected to the schools where the children are sort of most concentrated in New York City. And then the City Council, along with two foundations, the New York Community Trust and the Robin Hood Foundation, funded close to $2 million to essentially provide universal representation for the kids coming through the New York surge docket. And so that's really exciting. And I hope, you know, more than just a response to the child migrant issue, that it becomes then a stepping stone for us to think about how to use our school system as a way to connect kids, immigrant kids, to legal resources and other services like that. It's a part of the mayor's platform, and I think also something that teachers and guidance counselors were hearing from them, and they're saying our kids have complicated immigration issues. How do we connect them to the right resources, and how do we structure a referral system that actually works for the schools as well as for the kids and the legal services providers? So we're thinking about that now.
You mentioned the municipal ID, Nisha. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. So, you know, the municipal ID started, the first program was launched in New Haven, I think, in 2006 or 2007. And I know San Francisco, Oakland, a few other jurisdictions around the country have these programs. I think for New York City and for the mayor, the notion was really simple. We have 500,000 estimated undocumented people in New York City who cannot get identification because we don't have a driver's license that's available for all. And so the notion was, starting with them, you know, we really need to provide a government-issued local ID so that interactions with law enforcement are better. So if you're riding your bike on the sidewalk, instead of getting arrested because you don't have an ID, you can actually show your municipal ID and be able to get a summons like everyone else. To be able to access city buildings, my own building, you have to show an ID before you get in. Things like that, but then also seeing it really as a sort of vehicle for equalizing access to a number of different services and amenities in the city. So a few weeks ago, we announced a partnership with 33 of the city's leading cultural institutions, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, Lincoln Center, the Bronx Zoo, all of whom will provide one-year free membership to municipal ID card holders. And this is really sort of part of the idea of opening the doors of places like the Met and others, and they're very interested in actually diversifying their audiences, but really opening the doors to a broader cross-section of New York. And frankly, I think it makes the card very appealing to people who may already have a driver's license but don't get a free membership with their driver's license. And so we'll hopefully make this a card that all New Yorkers are carrying and not just the undocumented, and so therefore kind of removing some of the stigma associated with it. So the card launches January 1st. It's a bit of a hair-raising schedule to get this off the ground. And folks can sign up mainly through the libraries. And you basically have to be able to show some other form of photo ID and establish residency in New York City, and you can get your municipal ID. So expect to hear lots more about that in the coming months.
I'd love to hear how each of you sees the role of your sector in preparing for federal changes to immigration laws and policies. So the Global Detroits out there, not just Global Detroit, if you feel like you can speak about the Mosaic Project or others more broadly. And we'll start with you, Steve, and then we'll
sure.
down the line.
Well, the interesting thing, listening to Commissioner and the Senator, is that I'm just struck by how pragmatic and sort of common sense these policies are. They're asking questions about their own communities and what's in the best interest of their economy, of their quality of life, in terms of delivering government services, in terms of alleviating poverty and suffering, and they're coming to very common sense answers. And I think some of these issues have been foisted upon them by broken immigration systems, and we're stuck in this obsession about the undocumented instead of what people in Michigan are very concerned about, which is their economic future and their quality of life and their education systems. If we would actually just have a common sense conversation about what are the impacts that immigrants having in terms of the average quality of life, in terms of our local communities and our economies and our safety. I think we would have very different both state and local policies as well as federal policies, and certainly New York City and the state of California, you know, are kind of leading, probably because of the high presence of immigrants. But too often what we're seeing is this, you know, the issue of the undocumented being demagogued to prevent common sense approaches. So what we're doing in terms of preparing, you know, is we're trying to build a welcoming, functioning community in Southeast Michigan and across the state of Michigan. We, frankly, and it, you know, sometimes pains me as the former Democratic majority floor leader to say this, and particularly 3 weeks before an election, but we probably have the most, or we definitely have the most pro-immigration Republican governor in the country, and maybe even arguably one of the most pro-immigration governors in the country. And that's because Governor Rick Snyder really understands the economic opportunity and is often quoted as saying immigrants make jobs, they don't take jobs. And so when you bring a new lens and just ask the question, what's in it for our economy? What's in it for our public systems? You get to all kinds of new solutions. And the reality is that Global Detroit was founded upon bringing a lot of parties from the city to universities, to healthcare systems, to workforce development agencies, to businesses together, and sort of saying, how do we create jobs? How do we foster growth? And so we end up working on issues like trying to create, you know, better language access in our city, and we just completed a report of our Detroit City Council convened its first immigration task force and completed kind of a rough planning document, and the city announced itself as the 41st welcoming city in the Welcoming America's Welcoming Cities and Counties program in Macomb County, which is home to the Reagan Democrats, working class whites, union, Catholic, fairly socially conservative county of a little less than a million people. They've created the One Macomb Initiative that really does look at particularly the county's mental health systems and health services and how those get delivered to a very rapidly growing Middle Eastern, Bangladeshi, and Bosnian population in that community, as well as Latino. We don't have a grand plan, and this is happening on many levels, from county government to city government, and all of this began out of a private sector nonprofit convening and study of asking the question that was on really taking the issue of immigration or immigrants in our community and asking a question of what was at the core of Michigan and Metro Detroit's concerns in 2009, which is what's in it for our economy. And we end up working on a lot of issues that, frankly, immigrant rights groups, social service agencies have worked decades on. And sometimes with that new energy, those new partners, I think we're bringing new solutions, or we're championing old solutions, frankly, and giving them new energy to be successful. I'll just say that there's a lot of things I don't want to talk about that we've avoided on the state level because of Governor Snyder's support, that if some enterprising far-right anti-immigrant legislator even knew was happening behind the scenes, they would probably try to capture and figure out how to introduce it in the state legislature, and then we'd have a hot-button issue on our hands. So there's a lot of opportunity, and it is happening in other places as well, as I mentioned, and from St. Louis to Chicago to, you know, Dayton, which a very small immigrant population, has really embraced immigration as a revitalization and quality of life tool.
And do you see yourself kind of jumping into action if and when the president announces administrative reform?
Absolutely. So we've built a Welcome Mat network, which is an online searchable database of integration services from ESL programs and citizenship that is, you know, cross-tabulated by culture and by language. We have one of the most robust Welcoming America state affiliates when Welcoming Michigan, which received a White House Champion of Change Award a couple years ago. We're talking through everything from community colleges to local school systems to healthcare workers. I mean, there's just a myriad of aspects to integration. And again, I think that when we get off this sort of obsession, I think, of you know, undocumented people and who's here legally or our fear of refugees, and you get to what do most communities on a day-to-day basis, how do immigrants impact them? And the reality is that words like integration and economic opportunity and solutions that really not only have profound impact in immigrant and refugee populations, but frankly, create opportunities for receiving communities and host communities. There tends to be, and new players and partners from all sides of the aisle really seem to be embracing these things once we get beyond this you know, hot button issue.
I think, for the record, California is ready for California immigration reform, and we've been ready for a while. So I just wanted to put that for the record. You know, one of the issues that we've been trying to deal with as we prepare for one day comprehensive immigration reform is this issue of fraud prevention. And the idea has been floated around of creating at a state level the Office of New Americans that, you know, kind of seems that we're all on the same page on. And again, in California, there's kind of a patchwork of different things that are going on throughout the state. Cities have Office of Immigration Relations, Office of New Immigrants, but there's not really a one kind of hub where we're strategizing on how do we do outreach, how do we do education, how do we do fraud prevention, application and legal assistance, language courses, civics courses, and those things of that nature. But the main focus of that for us is fraud prevention. We've known, we've seen since the passage in 2001 of AB 540, which was a bill to allow undocumented students to pay in-state tuition, that we saw these little businesses pop up saying, give us $1,000 and we'll help you pay in-state tuition at your local college or university when it's completely free. And so that continues to be a problem for us. And even now, I'll tell you, we're scheduled to send out start providing our licenses for everyone January 1st in 2015. There's still a lot of hesitation from the immigration community, from the immigrant community, saying, is my information going to be shared? What happens if, we have a couple rogue sheriffs that say that they're not going to adhere to the law? And what happens if I get stopped or one of those cops in one of those counties? And all these different things, and rightfully so, right? Immigrants are survivalists. They've learned to kind of adapt and modify. But now this kind of shift and, oh, government's embracing. And if you look at the immigrants that are coming to the United States, and I use my parents as an example, they don't tend to go to government for help. They actually flee their government, or they're fleeing from their government. And so it's this kind of mind shift that we have to, education that we have to do with our immigrant population. And even if we ask them for one more document, they're like, well, why do you need this document? What about if we don't have this document to get a license? And so it's a constant education, constant reaffirming to them that, at least in California, we're not going to share your information with the federal government. And so we need some sort of kind of central hub that does this work 24 hours basis, because they need to feel, our immigrant community need to feel that there's somebody there, there's some sort of agency that's looking out for their best interest. And so as we continue to wait and hopefully one day we get immigration reform, we're thinking that an office of this nature under the governor's office would help not only continue to help integrate our immigrant populations, but give them the assurance that we are not collaborating with the federal government.
And in New York, we've started thinking we're not quite as ready as California, but we're getting there. And I guess sort of we see the cities having four different levers. One, we're a big funder of the different services that are going to have to kick in to be able to connect people to whatever executive action happens. And so we're starting to think about from the very simple level of making sure that whatever legal services and other providers have contracts with the city, that they're actually able to pivot to then serve the need that'll emerge with executive action, to really thinking about how do we create a system, right, rather than just kind of doling out millions of dollars of funds, to think about whether we're creating a system where you have legal services providers taking the sort of hardest cases, the community-based providers being able to do the outreach and the real connections to the community to share information about what is and is not happening with executive action. So that's one lever. We're a good convener, so I think this goes to the point of needing a kind of central hub. I think we're neutral among the different nonprofit providers that might be in the field and are organizing around this, but we can also convene our agencies, right? Our Department of Education, our different agencies are going to have to at some point provide documents to people to establish their presence, to establish, just like in DACA, any number of different things, and we can actually help prepare them to do that job so it's easier for those who are applying for whatever kind of deferred action comes down the pike. We have a lot of assets at our disposal. When the DACA renewal came up, one of the things that we did was actually launch a large-scale campaign around the renewal, but also just about DACA itself, using our transit system to have ads, using community ethnic media contacts. We saw like a several 100% increase in the number of inquiries around DACA as a result of some of that outreach. And so I think thinking about that experience and using it for executive action will be one strategy. And then, of course, we can be an advocate, where there are going to be lots of negative voices that will emerge when the president announces something. There certainly have been when immigration reform has been on the horizon. And as a city, we can stand up and say this is not only a good idea for the country, but this is how it concretely helps New York City, and it's not a bad thing. And the last thing I'll say is, you know, I agree completely with what Steve said about most of these policies are really common sense. Some of them we probably shouldn't even have to do, and it's not really revolutionary work. But I do think that one of the other things that's made possible, at least in New York City, what is happening very rapidly right now is an amazing community organizing infrastructure that got my boss elected, that got an incredible city council elected, and that's been really savvy about actually like moving the politics in a way where we can move things a lot more quickly than we have even in the past. And I think something like executive action, where you have community organizations with memberships that are going to be interacting with people about this, it's an opportunity to capitalize on that for membership growth, for actually, again, building that little p political power to then move for a larger scale immigration reform and really strengthening that. So that's unfortunately not my job anymore, but I do think that it's a critical part of this whole equation, is how we take the service delivery and move it into organizing and power building.
Steve? And I just want to build on that. I hope that as we move, whether it's administrative reform or congressional action, that the country has gotten more sophisticated about integration. I know that certainly as bad as things are today, they're probably better than they were when my grandfather came from Eastern Europe. And that we don't just look at the legal changes that need to be effectuated, which are very important, but we also talk about the integration that happens. And that happens in a myriad of levels. And I think that some of the insights just mentioned, like the distrust of government and even sometimes distrust in the nonprofit sector. And so, you know, we're delivering our largest initiative as a micro-enterprise initiative and for, you know, immigrant and African-American-owned businesses and entrepreneurs. And we've had to, you know, partner with churches and with frankly, parents groups at charter schools. And so we got to get more sophisticated rather than a one-size-fits-all. I mean, I think we got to look at what really has impact and what does integration really look like. And that's in the interest of not only from a social justice imperative in terms of helping new immigrants and refugees, but it's frankly in the quality of life and economic interest of the receiving communities and the majority populations. And when that integration is sped up and when it's delivered more effectively, we all benefit.
And can I just say also that whatever reform happens, it has to lead to citizenship. It can't be a permanent resident. At least that's what we're pushing for in California, that whatever immigration reform happens, that has to have a clear, non-expensive path towards citizenship.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, and when you look at a common sense approach, right, and you ask, like, what's in the interest of our local economies, it's statistically proven that when people become citizens, their earnings go up, they create more job openings from those beneath them, they invest more in our communities. It just makes no sense to me with people who want to be here and are economic contributors why we would not do something in our own self-interest to grow our economy and create better communities.
So, Senator Lara, you, when you're pushing this notion that there has to be a path to citizenship, and all of you are filling these gaps of federal immigration, or lack of federal immigration action, are you getting feedback from entities within the federal government, from ICE, from USCIS, the President's Office, Congress?
Well, the conversations we've had last year with our congressional folks was there was a push to have some sort of permanent resident status that wouldn't include necessarily a pathway to citizenship. That is not an option for us. For us, we need to ensure that folks, if they're going to invest time and energy, that they see a clear pathway, and that you know, that every immigrant has access to and to be able to become a citizen. We're seeing, yes, we have the model immigrants that everybody talks about, but in California, I mean, we have people from all gamuts of society, And they all have to ensure, we have to ensure that all of them have equal access to become citizens. Because as Steve was saying, you know, it helps with upward mobility. I'll tell you, it's proven time and time again in California and in the legislature, immigration tends not to be a hot topic anymore. The conservatives have lost that battle time and time again in California. And so what you're seeing is now a Republican Party that's much more moderate when it comes to this issue, and quite frankly, are work with us in a bipartisan fashion to create policy that really makes sense on immigration. And so we just want to make sure that whatever gets agreed to, that we have a clear path to citizenship, and again, that we take into consideration the cost and the time that it's going to take. We don't want to dissuade people from becoming citizens. And one of those big factors is obviously an economic factor, because not everybody who's an immigrant is an engineer. You have janitors, you have nannies, you have folks that are going to work 3, 4, 5 jobs to be able to become citizens, just like my parents had to do.
Mm-hmm. So in some respects, we actually have really good partnerships with federal agencies. We work closely with USCIS and with Phyllis and her team in New York on our citizenship initiatives, just as one example. In other cases, I mean, if I had to express sort of a frustration with one area where we don't get as much information, it's not that we're hearing from the federal government, but we're not getting enough, is really on data. So when the child migrant issue was initially breaking, we were really interested in knowing New York City specific numbers if we could. We eventually did get county level data, which were enormously helpful. But until then, it sort of felt like we were kind of in the dark, just in understanding how to respond even at the local level. So I think being able to get some information along those lines more quickly is really something that we're really eager to do. And then otherwise, I think we often reach out to the federal government to kind of engage them on some of our initiatives that implicate their work, and have totally sort of largely, I should say, open conversations about that. But the main area I think that I've been frustrated around has been data.
I think it's a real mixed bag. So there are a lot of individuals, I think, that are really open to having a conversation about how immigration, how services can be delivered in a more proactive manner. And at the same time, you know, we're home. I live literally about 100 yards from the most valuable international border crossing in this country in terms of the value of trade and goods going across the Ambassador Bridge between Detroit and Windsor. And we've had a lot of issues with ICE and Border Patrol in terms of raids and those kinds of things, and things where the local agents have violated national policy, and the follow-up and the relations with the community have been completely botched. And so it's a medium grade at best, and it really depends on the agency, the day, the issue. But there's certainly no kind of coordinated, I would say, proactive, long-term thinking focus on what and how the federal government can work with our immigrant and refugee communities in a way that will tackle what's most important to Michiganders and to Detroiters, which is how do we grow our economy.
Kind of forget that we have that northern border. I think you're representing the Midwest as well as the northern border for us here today. You're all phenomenal, the work that you're doing, and leaders in your sectors. And I'm just wondering, do you interact with other like entities around the country? You know, Nisha, are you working with other cities? And Senator Lara, other legislators must be so envious. Steve, I know you've talked a little bit about some other programs, so I'd love to hear a little bit about that.
Yeah, so we work with our sister Moyas around the country quite a bit. Most recently, we launched with Chicago and LA an initiative called Cities for Citizenship. And the idea is to both lift up the work that we've been doing in each of our cities to invest in naturalization programs in collaboration with our local community partners, but also to encourage other cities to do the same thing. And I hope that very soon you'll be hearing from a number of other cities around the country that have sort of signed on their mayors really wanting to invest in citizenship. And I think we could probably do better even in having more frequent conversations among the different cities, because many of us are dealing with the exact same issues. We're coming up with slightly different strategies in each of our jurisdictions, and could really learn a lot from having even more frequent conversations around that. But I think the sort of upsurge in local activity around immigration in the last few years has meant that there's that much more infrastructure for us to be able to work with one another, and then hopefully be coordinated and be able to push up a narrative to the national level.
Absolutely. I think coordination is key, especially with other states. But, you know, for us in California, we're also coordinating with other countries, and we look at what different models they have. We've gone to Israel several times. We're looking at Australia. We're looking at just different countries. Given how vast our population is and how diverse it is, there's not really apples-to-apples comparison. But rest assured, California is coming to a neighborhood near you. And so it behooves you to look at what we're trying to accomplish in California. But, we also like to partner with other countries to see what other models are happening. But, again, you can never collaborate enough. I think it's imperative for us to continue to do so.
I think that's a great question. And the answer is I think we're at a critical point where this infrastructure is just being built. This kind of legislation that's proactive, this mayor's office of immigrant affairs, this looking at immigrants as an economic development opportunity is a really and really a focus on integration. You know, we understandably, those who work with immigrants have been very focused on the immigrant rights and the comprehensive immigration reform without really the opportunity to look beyond that at these other questions of integration. And so I think that the infrastructure is rapidly developing. If I didn't mention, that we spearhead at Global Detroit, we staff in conjunction with Welcoming America, a 10-state regional Global Great Lakes network that has about 20 metros who have either launched an economic development initiative focusing on immigrants or are in the process of launching. And I mentioned many of those programs that were 4 years old. Some of them are we have two or three organizations that are older than that, like the Welcoming Center for New Pennsylvanians in Philadelphia, and Mayor Michael Coleman in Columbus, who has a New Americans Initiative that's 10 years old. So the Global Great Lakes Network is just recently formed. We've done two convenings. We'll do a third one in Dayton probably in June next year. We're writing a state and local policy playbook around economic development issues in our region. We're doing city-to-city visits where these programs are visiting each other and trying to learn from each other. We're using social media and research to kind of learn from each other. Almost all of us, I can't tell you how many times I've passed out the New York City blueprint for cities. I mean, unfortunately for cities like Detroit and Dayton, there's a lot in there that doesn't translate real well, but nonetheless, it is one of the first tools out there that we have, and we need to see more of those types of tools. I remember I served in the state legislature from 2003 through 2008. We had, in-state tuition issues. We had Dreamers Act issues. We had driver's license issues. I passed some legislation to, cracking down on notarios and immigration fraud. We didn't, at that point, have a single statewide advocacy voice to talk with the immigrant community. And while there was some great work that happened nationally, very little of it focused on the states and the kind of issues we were dealing with. So there's all kinds of new infrastructure. The Migration Policy Institute has done a lot of great research, as has the Immigration Policy Center, to help. The Pew Center and the work that Adam's doing, we're hoping will fill the void. And we're seeing a little more of funders look at these kinds of issues. But frankly, there's a lot more that needs to be done. It's not just a question of coordinating and energizing the immigrant community to advocate for immigration reform. But a lot has to be invested in these kind of quality of life integration issues. And frankly, as I said, I really consider this to be an important part of our national interest, that what really will make this country great for the coming century is our great universities, a good education system, and frankly, being able to attract the world's talent. And I use that term broadly to include, the hardworking people who may not have had an opportunity to get the kind of higher education that we strive for in this country. But those three things, I think, are the cornerstones of our economic success, our quality of life. And it's amazing to me that we've allowed our understandable obsession with immigration reform to get in the way of the other elements that we need to make this country, make our communities great.
Thank you. So before we go to questions from the audience, is there anything that any of you would like to add that you'd hope to mention and didn't get a chance yet?
I'd just like to talk also about the kind of educational obstacles that exist for immigrants, and how, as Steve was talking about, the great equalizer is an education, and is the reason why I'm actually sitting before you guys today as the son of two undocumented immigrants from Mexico. And so also, as we talk about immigration reform, we have to look at what educational obstacles remain not only in our state legislature, but are in our federal policies to also incorporate our immigrants. One of the big things that we're working on in California, we remember Prop 227, which limited the education to English only. And what it did, it decimated language immersion programs in California. But we see this resurgence now of from all Californians, regardless of ethnicity or social income, of wanting their children to learn multiple languages. And so we know the pedagogy has changed. When it once it be, was talk about, we, it used to be said that if you teach a child multiple languages at an early age, you're going to confuse a child. We know that's completely the opposite. But this was, you know, common sense and common knowledge in the 90s in California. And that's why, you know, the past is kind of anti-bilingual education, language immersion initiative. So what we did this year in the legislature was to repeal sections of that proposition, and actually included a lot of the language dealing with the fact that if we want to continue to be a global economy, we're going to have to ensure that the, our global workforce understands and communicates with each other. And that means that Californians have to speak more than just English. And, you know, in a couple hours, if not already, you know, thousands of children in California woke up speaking another language other than English. And so we have this natural reserve already that makes us competitive globally. Why not exploit that? Why not allow them to learn two, three languages like what they're doing in Asia, in Scandinavia, leading economies? And so we're changing the dynamic, we're changing the rhetoric, and this proposition will now go before the voters in 2016 to eliminate sections of Prop 227 and actually include more language that allows for the creation and establishment of not only dual language programs, but multi-language immersion programs that continue to be very popular. And I think, hopefully I'm crossing my fingers, that we'll get that passed, and that we once again tell our young immigrant children that it's okay to learn multiple languages, it's okay to learn Spanish, and you know, the world's languages, because that's what's gonna make you competitive, and in turn gonna make California competitive as well.
I mean, I just echo all that, and I think that the seal of biliteracy that was really created in California now is adopted in New York and six other states and about 150 local communities is some of that common sense approach, that just to recognize students who either grew up speaking English in their household and went on to learn another language, or those who are fluent in a native tongue and have graduated from an English-speaking high school, and just to acknowledge their skill level. It's almost a no-cost kind of implementation, but very forward-looking, and it adds absolutely strength to our global economy for those students, and it recognizes what they've achieved. And we need more policies like that. And I really thank California for coming up with that brilliant idea, and I'm hoping that someday the state of Michigan adopts a similar. And I know the Dearborn Public Schools in Metro Detroit already have, but it's something that really should be in all 50 states and all of our local communities.
The only thing I'd add, sort of building on what Steve said earlier, I think some of these integration issues, it's really interesting to look at like the politics of ID around the country, right? On the one hand, voter ID, on the other, municipal ID. There's like English only on the one hand, and there's language rights on the other, and we're sort of in this conversation, to put it, I guess, sort of euphemistically, around the country about integration issues, in addition to the kind of larger question of who comes in and who goes out. And I think New York sees itself as a player in that dialogue, and it's going to be ongoing. I think it's going to get worse before it gets better, but that's really sort of where I think the states and the cities are really playing, is being able to kind of put their stake in the ground in terms of what makes sense for our country moving forward.
We have time for questions. We do have staff who would be happy to move the microphones down the row so that if you're in the middle, we don't want you excluded from asking questions.
Father Ippolito, Catholic Charities, Raleigh, North Carolina. I have a question for the commissioner. Did I hear you correctly when you said that in order to get the New York City identification card, you need another ID card? You need a photo ID to get the ID?
Right. So
therein lies the problem with immigrants. I mean, most of the time, they don't have a photo ID. I mean, a lot of them, I'm going to say most of the time, a lot of them don't have a photo ID. You got to start someplace. How do you get a How do you get a New York City ID card if you don't have a photo ID?
Yeah, so there are a number, I mean, the number of IDs that you can show are pretty broad, so that includes foreign passports, foreign driver's licenses, matriculas, employer ID cards, school ID cards, a sort of range of different things. And then we're also going to have sort of special rules where different community-based organizations or social service organizations can help establish identity and residency for individuals as well. So this is sort of something that's part of our current rulemaking process, and lots of groups have been engaged making exactly those claims, saying that it's important to ensure that this is as inclusive as possible. We also have to be able to establish that the person is who they say they are. And so being able to find that balance, I think, has been one of the trickier operational issues for the ID program.
We'll go just back and forth.
Sure. Hi, good morning. My question is for you, Senator Lara. I'm a native Los Angelino, so I can say that I'm very proud of what our state has done. But I'm also an immigration officer with USCIS. So I would like to ask a question regarding how California is taking into consideration and vetting these individuals as it pertains to national security and public safety concerns. I'm just, if you could expand a little bit on
under which program?
We'll say, for example, the California driver's license laws. So you had said that, you know, you're not collaborating with the federal government. However, there are national security concerns in this country, and California is not exempt from that. So if you could just expand a little bit on some of the measures that the state is taking for screening and vetting individuals with national security concerns.
It's a good question. We, just as the city ID, we went through this rulemaking process in terms of how do we identify the person and how do we know that that's the actual person that's applying for the license. And so we went through a long rulemaking process, but we are operating under the rightful assumption that not every immigrant is a terrorist. And so we...
They're not all innocent either, though.
Correct. But the majority of the folks here are not, you know, nothing what I think would have stopped what happened in September 11th. But, I mean, understanding that is that I think we in our departments are doing everything they can to ensure that we identify the person, we know that who this person is, and it is a kind of a challenge of that balancing act, right? How do we encourage folks to actually, and also an understanding that if a person is coming seeking a driver's license, they want to be part of the system, they want to identify themselves, they want to be an active member of society and be able to take their kids to school without the fear of getting their car impounded. They want to be able to go to work. They want to be able to continue to contribute to our economy without that constant fear of just driving. And so we're very cognizant of that fact. And obviously, you know, we're not our own country. If the federal government needs to, you know, do what they have to do to be able to identify a person, well, you know, we'll be able to provide that. And so it's, I think, for the safety of all of us that we get people registered, that people get a license, and so we know who's driving in our streets and who's, you know, living in our community. And so the beauty about living in such a diverse state is that, you know, we're comfortable with being different. We're comfortable with seeing people from different parts of the country. But again, national security is definitely a problem and an issue that we need to address. But our kind of frame of mind is the more folks that are obtaining these driver's license, then we know who these folks are.
Thank you.
I worked on these issues in the Michigan legislature when we had Real ID that came into effect post 9/11. And the reality is that driving 11 million people underground and operating without identification and insurance is actually the wrong strategy to be able to find the people who might harm us and terrorize us. That the reality is having policies in which law enforcement and police are and identifications are open and usable by even those who are undocumented creates a better system for law enforcement, for national security, to be able to find the bad operators and root them out. And so you can go to the, by the way, on the local level, I highly recommend going to the Police Foundation. It's a national organization that's done a lot of research on this about how to work with undocumented communities in a proactive manner that helps solve crimes, create safer communities, and frankly is more respectful of undocumented communities.
Good morning. Michael Cooper of the Plowshare Group. I'm also a member of the New York City Bar Association's Committee on Immigration and Nationality Law. Hello, Nisha.
Hi.
This has been a great panel. We've heard a lot this morning about what cities and states have done, are doing, and may do in the future. I wanted to probe a little bit more the issue of what we can refuse to do. And I'll point this question to you, if I may, Commissioner. I'm specifically interested in the state of play. Our committee in New York has recently testified before the City Council regarding noncompliance with ICE detainers. So there's one good example about what can be done. So I'd be interested to hear you talk about the state of play in New York on that issue, and then if other panelists have thoughts about further things that states and cities can refuse to do. Thanks.
Sure. So the current state of play in New York City is that the City Council Speaker has introduced legislation that would dramatically expand and therefore dramatically decrease the extent to which New York City complies with ICE detainers. Specifically, the law would require a judicial warrant for any honoring of a detainer as a sort of initial matter, and then even then would require a serious or violent felony conviction within the last 5 years. This is very different from what was possible in the prior administration, where even some misdemeanor charges were causing people to have their detainers be honored. There's also, ICE has been operating a trailer on Rikers Island, our sort of local jail, for many years now, somewhat mysteriously. Nobody even at the Department of Corrections knows how that happened. So that's troubling. The local law would also remove ICE's facility at Rikers Island. And at that same hearing, I also testified saying that the mayor and the administration are in support of the legislation as it currently stands. We still have to go through some final negotiations, but sincerely believe that it's on the margins and that hopefully very soon we will have a bill that will pass the City Council and be signed by the mayor that would virtually eliminate New York City's compliance with ICE detainers.
So what we did, one of the big things that we decided not to comply with was with the federal law that would require our local law enforcement to collaborate with federal agents. And that was a bill that we did called Secure Communities, ensuring that, you know, what was happening, you know, the discussion nationally of, you know, trying to detain these bad guys wasn't translating in California. What was happening is you would get somebody who was selling you paletas on the corner, then somehow now, you know, get arrested for not having a permit to be able to sell on the street. Next thing you know, they're being deported, tearing families apart. And we saw that time and time again. We saw people that were intimidating home care workers, saying that, you know, we're not going to pay you, and we're going to tell, you know, the law enforcement that you're here illegally. And so what we decided was to protect our own immigrant community in California and say we were not going to follow federal law, and we're not going to adhere to that. And that was a big, tremendous victory. And again, changing the paradigm shift and the discussion from a kind of a gotcha mentality to like, we need to do everything we can to incorporate our immigrant community, who the vast majority are good, hardworking people that want an opportunity to the American dream. Why did our parents come here? Why did, you know, your ancestors come here? Because this is the most amazing country in the world. And only in the United States of America can the son of a seamstress and a factory worker from East LA now serve in the eighth largest economy in the world, which is the state of California. So people does not lose that fact. People are going to continue to come here because it's a great place to be. It's the most amazing country. But we have to ensure that we change the dialogue and that we're being proactive in saying that you're here, let's make sure we incorporate you, and that we lessen your fear of being a productive member of our society.
Good morning. My name is Martha Sardinas, and I'm retired from the State Department. I'm a former visa officer. And I just moved to California from Maryland, and fortunately did not need a visa to move there. So well, I went to a conference last week in San Diego, and they were talking about specifically the Mexican immigration. They were overjoyed by the new law about the driver's licenses. But what I found so interesting was they referred to Los Angeles as a sanctuary city and as certain suburbs of San Diego as not sanctuary cities. But the immigrants can't leave those cities because they are less expensive, they're easier to live in. But the local city councils, we could have a totally different panel here of local city councils that are doing everything they can to make sure that the immigration laws are enforced. And they're kind of the reflection of what you're doing. So what my concern would be, and of course I hope that someday the federal government takes the action it needs to take, would be that we start to have pockets of sanctuaries and cities that are, you know, working with law enforcement to, like along maybe the Texas border, they're gonna go and enforce the law if the federal government can't do it. So I wondered if you'd comment on that and how we can bridge this divide. I mean, my interest is in conflict resolution of these issues and not to divide our country even further on this issue.
You're absolutely right. We have a group of folks who visit my office quite often who are at the California border with Mexico, and you know, they do, and you're absolutely right. I'm painting a picture here that, you know, California, we're progressive and we're leading immigration issues, but that has taken time. And we still have pockets of if you've seen the Murrieta issue where these children were turned away. And it begged for us in the legislature where, you know, if there were a bunch of brown people or people of color stopping federal agents, what would happen to us? We would have been arrested. And so the dynamic is still kind of very vitriolic in California, especially when you go inland. People tend to divide California north and south, but I think we're more, you know, west coast to the inland Inland Empire, we say in California. But again, I think as immigrants continue to incorporate themselves in society, I equate it similar to as a gay man, as you meet somebody who's LGBT and they're parts of your society, they become part of your family, it changes the rhetoric, it changes the tone. And I think, I'll tell you, in 2001 when I was working on AB 540 and when we were talking about how do we get students to out themselves as undocumented, it was difficult. People were really scared, especially if you lived your entire life thinking you were a citizen until it was time for you to fill out your FAFSA to go to college when your parents had that conversation with you. And so we see now these Dream Act students taking their lives and taking charge of their own lives. They are, you know, they're active, open members of our society, and immigrants are beginning to get, you know, as we introduce more policies that help them, you see them kind of coming out of the shadows. And so I think that helps. And again, seeing immigrants as our neighbors, as our coworkers, it helps. And I think that's kind of what has helped every kind of social movement, is the incorporation of these communities into our mainstream society.
I just want to let those struggling South Californians know that Detroit is a very low-cost option. Very low cost, incredible value for your dollar. We are a so-called sanctuary city, something we passed about 10 years ago. I actually really don't like that terminology. I don't know who created it, because frankly, as I just going back to the policing remarks, the reality is that we want to create a safe environment in which people are forthcoming to our local police for law enforcement. We do have a lot of violent crime in the city of Detroit relative to other communities, and we need people who are willing to work with the police, and that requires us to focus on not on immigration issues when we're solving crimes and burglaries and those kinds of things, but focus on policing issues. And it's documented. I mean, the Police Foundation, again, shows that having a policing policy that only asks about immigration status when it's critical to solving the policing issue at hand is a better policing policy for safety and for what we want our police to do. So it, to me, it's a smart policing policy. It's not about being a sanctuary city and getting involved in the federal immigration debates. It's about having good policing in our immigrant communities in the city of Detroit. But again, you can get a house for about $35,000. You can open a business for less than $100,000. We're a welcoming city. We have microenterprise training. A welcome mat, whatever you need, we welcome you.
We're about at time, but I know that you've all been standing there waiting to ask your questions, so we'll try to be very brief and get you all out of here in just a couple minutes.
Sure, thank you so much. My name is Natalie Camastro. I'm with the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health, and I just wanted to thank you, Senator Lara, for your visionary leadership on health for all. It's something that here in Washington, D.C., we've been very, very excited about. As an organization that works in places like Texas and Florida, and even on a national level, we hear devastating stories every day of immigrant women who are dying from preventable diseases because of not only the restrictions on the federal and state level, but the decimation of the safety net in many of these states. And so we know that this is a long-term fight, but I was wondering, and also I just want to add that the UN has actually recognized this summer in two different concluding observations that these restrictions on immigrants' access to healthcare do violate international obligations. So we're very interested in, moving the needle in some of these states and in the federal on the federal level where the political climate isn't as friendly. So I'd be interested in hearing some lessons learned in California that maybe could be applicable to other states, or maybe some more shorter term strategies in states and on the federal level where, again, the political climate isn't as responsive. What are maybe some lessons learned that we could apply to some of these more hostile situations?
Thank you. Quickly, lessons learned. Every immigrant group and every immigrant rights organization has their own opinion on how to fund healthcare for all. Some of them want it completely paid by the government through our general fund. And those of us that are more pragmatic are trying to come up with ways of how to fund this program. If we're going to, we've already increased by, I think it was like 3 million people, our healthcare roles now with Medi-Cal given the ACA. So now the work is how we justify, okay, how are we going to further expand it to include this vulnerable population and how are we going to pay for it? And so the variety of opinions of how that gets done, I underestimated. I thought it was going to be a lot easier to get people together and figure out. So now we know, and we have a more of a clear strategy moving forward next year.
Good morning. My name is Courtney Lee, and I'm a third-year law student here at Georgetown. Thanks for coming today. My question is for Commissioner Agarwal, as I hope to move to New York after this and be an immigrant advocate. So we've heard a lot in the media about the New York Family Unity Project, as well as the Immigrant Justice Corps, and I'm wondering, what other programs are there that the city has supported, and what major challenges in progress have you seen?
Sure. So the New York Immigrant Family Unity Program is universal deportation defense funded by the city, by the city council dollars. And then the Immigrant Justice Corps is privately funded expansion of immigration legal assistance through fellowships that was really spearheaded by Judge Katzmann of the Court of Appeals. So in addition to those two programs, the city has historically funded something called the Immigrant Opportunities Initiative, or IOI, that started as sort of discretionary city council funding, and now it's been baselined, which means that it's going to be part of the administration's budget time and again. And so that's exactly the piece of the funding that we're looking at to figure out how can we further bolster immigration legal services, but also do it in a way where we're engaging community-based partners who aren't necessarily providing legal services but are doing lots of important work connected to that legal services. So that's the process that we're in right now. And I think there'll be a question of sort of the Family Unity Program and other things. Will they continue year after year? Is that something that's also going to be baselined? And I think all of those questions are up for grabs. And I think being able to establish that these legal services programs actually save the system money in the long term is very important, and I know some research has been done on that. But also the argument we're trying to make and we'll be doing a study on is that it's important from a poverty fighting standpoint. You know, Mayor de Blasio has really emphasized the importance of sort of challenging inequality in our city, and lack of immigration status, but even just not being a U.S. citizen, keeps people back in many ways economically and keeps them shut out of programs that can lift them out of poverty. And so I think making that connection between immigration legal services as poverty fighting is really central to what we want to do.
Thank you. Stick around this afternoon for the last session on models.
Okay, I'll make it quick, or I'll try. I'm Kate Hibbs. I work with the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, and we're interested in immigrant banking, and you guys talk about access to healthcare, access to education, those kinds of things. What about access to financial services? And especially when immigration costs, legal costs will be thousands of dollars over someone's lifetime, DACA renewal being over, you know, $500, et cetera. How do we help? How are you guys working with financial institutions, or better yet, nonprofit lenders? And you talked about financial fraud and helping against that, and, you know, notarios are dubious at best. So how are you guys working with financial institutions to bring people into the financial mainstream and help people finance shifting their immigration status, amongst other things?
So I think you're absolutely right. Financial empowerment is essential. Under the framework that we're working with in terms of this Office of New Americans, there has to be a financial empowerment component, because we can talk here until we're blue in the face about poverty and you know, financial equity and so forth. But what we do see is, especially in California, that our immigrants come with a very strong entrepreneurial spirit. I think it's a matter of survival as well. I mean, my mom, when she lived here, when she was here undocumented, she would sell you anything. She was selling you Avon, jewelry, shoes. And so I thought about the fact is, how do we capture that entrepreneurial spirit? And how do we give, you know, people like my mom at that time some sort of pathway to allow herself to build her own business? Or if you're selling tamales in the corner and you have, you know, 100 customers, how do you build that to make that into the best tamale maker in California, and you become, you know, world renowned for your tamales, right? And so we're working with a lot of the financial institutions, the big banks in California nationally, because, I mean, it behooves them as well, right? I mean, they see this as a new market, especially in California. So they're part of the discussion. When we look at the smaller banks as well, the community banks, they're all on the in the table with us, having these discussions of how do we encourage them, even just to bank on. If we talk about like the Bank On San Francisco, Bank On California, there's been Bank On movements all over, again, incorporating our immigrants into their financial institutions. And not only that, but allowing them and helping them to build wealth, and to say that it's okay to build wealth. You want to leave something for the next generation, and you shouldn't feel bad about that. And so we're kind of changing that discussion as well in California. It's a big component of our Office of New Americans, and it's a great point you brought up.
I'll just be very brief. First of all, we could have given your mom a loan through our Prosperous Microloan program. But second of all, this and really NCRC, I hope, will help us. Detroit, Toledo, and some of these Rust Belt cities have land bank properties that we're trying to use for redevelopment, and we're having problems because undocumented people who have a history of buying vacant property, moving in, and creating great new home ownership in urban neighborhoods, post 9/11, some of the security things that we've put into place can no longer get home mortgages. So we have a huge problem of financing that, and we have to figure out what those solutions are, and we're trying to do that every day on the ground right now.
Last question?
So for the last question, my name's Ellen Street, and I work for DSF Consulting, and we do professional development for teachers that work with ESL students. So oftentimes when we're trying to empathize with ESL families and try to get them involved and connected, they're afraid that whenever we send anything home, whether, especially when it's in English, but just in general, that, oh, well, why am I being called in? You know, parent-teacher conferences, and they're afraid of deportation or that type of thing. How do you suggest that we begin that conversation to bridge to ESL families?
Well, I mean, as somebody who lived that firsthand, you know, I think we need to have a conversation with our immigrant communities. The level of respect that immigrants have towards education authority figures, like a teacher, very, very well respected. And so whatever the teacher says is kind of law, right? In our family, in my family at least, it was. With that said, there is this issue of immigrants, and in my own experience I can speak of, is like you get dropped off at school and they go to work. Parents go to work 2-3 jobs and they assume that you're educating their child. And so there's an organization that I belong to called PIKE that integrates a lot of the immigrant communities to even let them understand what a school board is, what a principal, what you know, what your rights are as a parent, how to read your child's report card. And so we need more investment in these organizations that help integrate the parents more into their educational system, because they're very different depending on what part of the country, of the world you come from. And so we need more of the resources to help help transition the parents to understand our own educational system, which varies from state to state, city to city. You know, so it's a very complex issue, but very important for us to continue dialogue. You know,
let's give a round of applause to our fabulous speakers. Our next panel begins at 11:30, so that's in about 10 minutes. Thank you, everybody.